This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're live from our New Haven Bureau at Gateway Community College. You can join the conversation on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Colin McEnroe is out this week, and the cameras of CTN are joining us in New Haven today. Today in the program, we have three special guests, and we're very excited, as always, to have the guy who knows more about New Haven than anyone else, Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent. Thanks so much for being here, Paul. I appreciate it. Good to see you.
It's always great to see you, John.
And we also have Liz Karantowicz, who's our Republican political analyst. Hello there, Liz.
Good morning.
Yeah, we can't quite hear Liz yet, so we're working very hard.
Okay with
All of our liberal friends are saying yes. No, we're actually, I promise you, we're going to hear from Liz Karantowicz in just a second. And we may or may not hear from Neil Vigdor, political reporter at the Hartford Current. Hey there, Neil.
Good morning.
Yeah, so we can't hear from Neil either. This is very exciting. So what here's what we're going to do. We're going to do the Paul and John show for a couple minutes.
We can give me a new mic. Can you hear this one?
I can hear that one.
All right.
I can hear your old mic. Everyone can hear you, Paul. Let's start with the news, and someone I'm sure will wave at me whenever we can hear from our other guests. In a primetime announcement on Monday, sort of set like a reality show, President Trump unveils D.C. Circuit Court Judge Brett Kavanaugh as his pick to replace retiring swing vote Justice Anthony Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't think we're surprised, Paul, that, you know, Richard Blumenthal and Senator Chris Murphy sort of fell all over themselves trying to be the first out of the gate to say, no, we're not going to vote for this guy. As a matter of fact, let's actually hear from Senator Blumenthal right now.
Our colleagues are going to have to know that this vote is career defining. This is how history will remember them. This one is for a vote that on the court will in fact determine whether we roll back the clock to criminalizing abortion and deny funding for critical women's health care, and whether we eviscerate the protections for millions of Americans suffering from pre-existing conditions and decimate affirmative action and other civil rights issues, gay rights, whether we turn back the clock on marriage equality. Those stakes are real here. And they are real for Republicans as well as Democrats.
So that's Senator Richard Blumenthal, who, of course, along with Senator Chris Murphy, are going to be two no votes on the Democratic side. Paul, as you watch this, I mean, what are some things you see out of this? Obviously, the Democrats are viewing this quite a bit differently than they viewed other Supreme Court picks, including that of Neil Gorsuch, who they took a little bit of time before they said no, in part because they had, you know, Antonin Scalia had passed away, and there was a sense that maybe we were still operating under what we're calling normal order. Now the Democrats in the Senate say, look, we can't have the Kennedy vote go to a guy who's a Trump pick like Kavanaugh.
I think this is all about the Ocasio-Cortez victory in New York and the midterm elections. I think both parties struggle with how they respond to a base to stay in power and how they think politics should work. So I agree with you, John. I think that if this were not the Supreme Court nomination that would cement a new majority for the rest of maybe our lifetimes, they would deal with it under more normal circumstances. There's also been this upping the ante where the Democrats got rid of the filibuster for all judge nominations except for in the Senate, except for Supreme Court. Then the Republicans took the next step to stop Obama from picking a Supreme Court justice in his last year, and then they abolished the filibuster there. So I think each party is seeing norms go out the window and wondering how far do you go in continuing that process and how much you try to stick to the norms mm-hmm. you believe that we should have. And in this case, Trump made a really smart pick because this guy is very respected. He's a real judge. And he has the best record among his finalists of seeming like we'll let Trump off the hook if he wants to deny a subpoena.
Yeah, a real judge, as a matter of fact. Just on Morning Edition this morning, we heard from Akhil Reed Amar, who's a Yale Law School professor. He wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times, a liberal's case for Brett Kavanaugh. Not a whole lot of liberals, Liz, coming out and being in support of anything coming out of the Trump administration. What do you see in this pick from your side of the aisle?
Well, I think it's an opportunity to sort of frame a conversation about, you know, our democracy. And I think it's one of the most exciting things as a political science geek to watch. I think your points about, you know, sort of upping the ante on the process side has been incremental and bipartisan. But the narrative on the Democrat side is what it's been. It's fear. It's not about anything beyond that. And I think what you see with Judge Kavanaugh is somebody that will go through the process with bipartisan support. I think you'll see the newest senator from Alabama likely supporting him. I think you'll see Senator Donnelly supporting him. I think you'll see Joe Manchin supporting him. So there will be bipartisan support. But, you know, guys like Chris Murphy and Dick Blumenthal, they have to sort of do what they do, which is thump their chest and create hysteria and, you know, sort of try and you know, create a platform for themselves, you know, to continue raising money and building their own profile. This is more about the individual senators than it is about the process. I don't think that there seems to be a whole lot there for people to have an issue with Kavanaugh. He's been through the process. He's you know, he's sort of been an even-keeled, you know, middle-of-the-road jurist.
Well, middle of the road, I think.
In the sense that there's plenty of people on both sides of the aisle who have issues, right? So there's conservatives on the right that have problems with some of his decisions. There's folks on the left who have problems with his decisions.
But there's no doubt that on the long list of issues that are important to Democrats, he can be considered pretty reliable vote. They're always worried about, all the Republicans are worried that a lot of their nominees turn out to be more liberal over time, as long as they're on the bench, whether it's Souter, whether it's Kennedy, even Roberts, they're starting to call a liberal. And I think they wanted someone who felt they can really depend on them when it comes to gay rights, abortion rights, that they know that they're not going to waver.
Well, but I don't know that that's true. I mean, I think, again, you know, Kennedy is a great example of somebody who's a conservative, was appointed by a conservative. He's a Catholic, you know, not too dissimilar from Judge Kavanaugh, and he's the one that wrote the majority opinion on gay mm-hmm. marriage. So I think, again, it's difficult for Democrats for that to be the reality, that you know, a conservative judge that was appointed by a conservative president would have written the opinion in the majority on the legalization of gay marriage. That doesn't work with their narrative, so they can't sort of operate in that environment.
Let me just jump in and say, Neil, and I think I've got your microphone now. The narrative, though, for Democrats is actually shifting a little bit. I mean, and Paul has laid out some of the things that the Democrats are going to be very concerned about any Trump judge, any conservative judge that a Republican president of any sort is going to put forward. They're going to be worried about Roe versus Wade. They're going to be worried about gay rights. They're going to be worried in this context about the Affordable Care Act. But there's this other thing. Judge Kavanaugh, being someone who maybe Trump can rely on to think that presidential powers are pretty broad and that maybe the president can get away with some stuff that other people in America can't get away with, that seems to be something that the Democratic base could use to energize themselves.
Well, before Trump even announced the pick on Monday night, you had Dick Blumenthal on Anderson Cooper's show on CNN talking about how Judge Kavanaugh would be the swing vote on the court and really could determine whether or not Trump would be compelled to testify in the Russia investigation, whether or not Trump could pardon himself. And so that narrative was even there before Trump announced the pick. And one of the other interesting takeaways, you know, I had thought that a lot of this would be about reproductive rights, Roe versus Wade. The first messaging from Chris Murphy, if you looked at his Twitter feed Monday night, was on Judge Kavanaugh's record when it comes to guns. And the Heller versus District of Columbia Circuit Court decision, he wrote the dissenting opinion. And people see this as him being very much, a Second Amendment, a jurist that will kind of lean towards industry, whether it's the firearms industry, whether it's in the area of the environment and, energy company, oil, that kind of stuff. So I think this kind of goes beyond the whole Roe versus Wade fight that we have have been hearing.
Well, and I'd love to hear from you, Paul, about this. I mean, as you talk to voters, people who are going to be on the ballot at any sort of municipal, at statewide, going for the legislature again this year, are all of these issues, as embodied by a Supreme Court pick like this, are these enough to start to get Democrats more riled up and more ready to go to the polls in November?
That's obviously the point. You saw Ned Lamont, who's running for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination, and William Tong, the Attorney General Democratic candidate, at the front of the demonstration last night at the courthouse. Yes, it's a key galvanizing issue. This is about the election, as I said, about norms, because traditionally, if you win in a presidential election, you win the Senate, you get to pick the Supreme Court justice, and what you're really trying to vet is whether they really know the law and if they're capable, and clearly this guy is. But given the absence of norms, I really think people are looking at, as you said, this Supreme Court nomination as a way to galvanize the base for the midterm elections, which is very interesting in Connecticut, because in our statewide elections this year, the Republicans are banking on people hating Malloy more than they hate Trump in Connecticut, and Democrats are banking on people hating Trump more than they hate Malloy, and that they're just going to keep saying those words until they can finish.
So what do you I mean, if Paul's analysis is correct, I would tend to agree with a lot of what he's saying there. I mean, what does that mean for Republicans?
Well, I think that when you talk to voters in the state, the frustration level with the direction the state is going is very high. And I think Democrats will do a disservice to themselves if all they do is run against Trump, because they will, in doing so, ignore the issues that every resident in the state is feeling. And Republicans will do themselves a disservice, too, if all they focus on is Dan Malloy. I mean, you can't just point a finger and blame. You have to offer an alternative. And clearly that's worked in the legislative process of elections. I mean, we've won a considerable number of seats in the legislature over the course of the last 6 years, especially. But, you know, for Democrats to ignore the reality that most of the residents of this state are living in and only focus on sort of these hyper-partisan, hyper-political issues, which seems to be what they're doing, you know, I think it's going to you know, fall on deaf ears.
Hyper-partisan, hyper-political, perhaps, but also hyper-important to an awful lot of people. I mean, these are the issues that matter to not just Democratic voters, but to a lot of unaffiliated voters.
And I'm glad you made that brought that up, because one of the things is that here in Connecticut, from a bipartisan perspective, both at the executive level with Republican governors, at the legislative level, where we've had, and at the congressional level when we had Republicans in Congress, you had a group of Republicans, and you have a group of Republicans who are not on opposing sides of those issues. And so I think that's where Democrats have a problem, is because
I think it's both parties
have
a problem.
Well, but Democrats especially, because they want to talk about, you know, these issues at a federal level. And Connecticut Republicans have shown a very different temperament and a different way in dealing with some of these issues. I'm not going to say that all Republicans are moderate in some of their social positions, but Democrats are ignoring the reality that many of the progress we've made on some of these issues has been done in a bipartisan way.
I think one of the things that's harder to measure is, you know, we've heard anecdotally that, you know, Supreme Court picks are big for the Republican base as well. And I think that, you know, we're seeing all these protests on the steps of the Supreme Court outside the New Haven County courthouse. And so we see what the left's response is to this. But I do think that there is a Republican base out there that is fired up about this, too. And I think that's more difficult to measure. And when you look back at 2016 and you see that, you know, all the people that supported Trump, and that was kind of missed by the media for the most part, I think it's hard to kind of measure how many people are fired up on the right over this.
And I think it underscores the point of excitement, right? I mean, this is what winning elections is for, right? I mean, when you win elections at the state level, at the federal level, you get to make decisions, you get to govern. And so I think from that perspective, you know, Republicans will have, to your point, you know, maybe a little more fire in the belly, particularly in Connecticut, where we need so much change.
And I think we've heard quite a bit over the course of the last couple of days that, by and large, Republicans tend to be more energized by Supreme Court picks than Democrats. Democrats are going to try to get energized over this one. How about another issue, perhaps, Paul, that Democrats are getting galvanized around? We've discussed in the program outrage over immigrant children being separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. Two of those kids sent to a Connecticut facility are suing the federal government with the aid of attorneys from the Yale Law School Legal Clinic. The government has failed to meet a federal court order to reunify all these kids under five with their families by this week. How much do you see this playing into these November elections, Paul? Is this an issue that we will continue to be thinking about, talking about immigration by and large, not just at the U.S.-Mexico border, but the way that the Trump administration has viewed immigration?
I do, and it's not the Trump administration, also the Malloy administration. We are basically a sanctuary state. And I do think the issue resonates here. And to your point earlier, I think you're very right that the Democrats are looking more at national issues. And they're tying it into, there's a big part of the country that feels that fascism's coming. And like this is the moment, like the 1930s, you got to take a stand. And even though it's happening in Washington and in other parts of the country, that they're worried about starting with that the legislature could turn Republican this year. And there are actually state issues that involve immigration, like how the state police can respond to detainer requests. And, you know, I think it's a shame what you're saying, that I do agree that bipartisan legislation gets a lot of stuff done, like when you had the split legislature in the early 80s with Ralph Van Nostrand and Republican leader in Hartford, and they did some good work there. It's kind of hard to do in our current political moment. As you said, also, all elections, I think, on both sides are turning into how to tear down, how to get you scared of somebody on the other side rather than inspire people the way Obama or Reagan inspired their bases with positive visions.
Yeah.
Well, I I'll just say, Liz, and this is something you and I've talked about on the program before, too, is I totally take your point that the reason you win elections is so you can govern, and you govern the way you govern so that you can make the choices that you make. The problem with that is then we get into a situation where winning each election is the only thing that matters. And as you win each election, we further get into these divides in which we absolutely want to make sure that the next 4 years or the next 6 years, or with the Supreme Court justice, the next 30 years might be taken over by our ideology. And I guess I just wonder if the winner take all way in which we run and win our elections is a big part of the problem that we're dealing with right now.
Well, it's interesting. I think back to the point about bipartisanship, and you see the way that the legislature in the last 2 years has worked together with a very slim majority for Democrats in the House and a split state Senate. They've actually accomplished things, and that's something that both leadership groups have talked about. And so when you talk about governing, I think they've shown a way to do that and to do it effectively in an environment where you have an executive leader who was antagonizing them through that process and did everything to thwart their success at the bipartisan level and continued to do so by, you know, inserting himself in that process. And so I think that, you know, a credit to the leaders in both caucuses, in both parties, in both chambers, you know, for the way that they've comported themselves over the course of the last 2 years.
It's a little more complicated than that, but I think I agree. I mean, Malloy felt that he had a rising executive, that if legislature was going to punt on some issues involving debt and not truly having a balanced budget, that he's supposed to step in on that. He felt he had to be the grown-up in the room.
But he wasn't, because he left the room. And that was the problem, right? I mean, that, you know, he sort of said in that process, if I don't get my way, I'm going to go home. And that was basically what happened.
I just want to quickly loop back to the immigration issue, Neil, and say I think we need to recall that when given an opportunity a couple of years back, when there was another crisis of a whole bunch of young kids showing up unaccompanied at the border, and there was questions about which states were going to take in these unaccompanied minors. At the time, in the middle of a very important political season, Governor Malloy said, not so much.
No, on the Southbury Training School. And, yeah, I think that the whole issue of immigration is going to be huge in the general election. We see Mayor Ganim couple of weeks ago, going down to El Paso, going outside one of the detention centers with a group of other mayors, de Blasio, Garcetti, there to make political statements on the family separation policy. The optics of it, it's definitely problematic for Republicans. And then contrast that with, say, Mayor Boughton and Danbury with his immigration policy there, and the whole situation with the Danbury 11 and Danbury working with ICE to round up day laborers and then having to pay out a settlement to these people. There's no doubt that this is going to come up a lot in the fall.
When we come back, we're going to preview the first Democratic gubernatorial primary debate between Ned Lamont and Joe Ganim, and we're going to look at why one of the Republican rivals for that job is still waiting for public campaign financing for the state. Turn to the governor's race. We're talking with Neil Vigdor, political reporter at the Hartford Current, Liz Karandowitz, who's a Republican political analyst, and Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent. We're live in New Haven today on The Wheelhouse. Be right back. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're live today from our New Haven Bureau at Gateway Community College. You can join our conversation on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Colin McEnroe is out this week, and we've got the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network, here today. We're joined in our studio by Paul Bass. He's the editor of the New Haven Independent. He's also got a great radio show on WNHH, the great little radio station that you can hear all over New Haven. It's got a lot of local news on it, and he's going to talk to him in a moment about how he's talked to so many of the candidates for governor. Liz Karandowitz is here. She's a Republican political analyst, and another person who's talked to a lot of these candidates, Neil Vigdor. He's a political reporter at the Hartford Current. Well, I will say that tomorrow on our show, Where We Live, Lucy Nalpathanchel sits down with Ned Lamont, who is the presumed frontrunner for the Democratic nomination. Tomorrow night here in New Haven at the Schubert Theater, Ned Lamont and Joe Ganim squaring off for the first Democratic gubernatorial primary debate. Ganim has announced this week that his campaign has raised just shy of $800,000 thus far in this election, with more than $300,000 left to spend before the August 14th primary. Ned Lamont picked up another endorsement on Tuesday, this time from the Working Families Party. I'll start with you, Neil. What do you expect to see in this debate between these two very different candidates?
Well, I think we're going to see more of Joe Ganim, trying to contrast himself with Lamont, trying to cast himself as the populist, flawed everyman, and that Lamont is a guy who's got 8 bathrooms in his house in Greenwich, and we're going to see more of Ganim challenging Lamont to limit his primary spending to $1 million. And if I was Ned Lamont, I would come back and say, the reason that you're not eligible for campaign public financing is because you were in prison for 7 years for public corruption.
Yeah.
And I think that that's probably a good way to shoot that down. I think that, Lamont will probably look to play it safe and come back to this kind of theme of, well, here's my vision, here are my ideas. This should be less about the personalities. This should be about policy and issues. I expect that Ganim is going to come out the aggressor.
But, yes, maybe Ned Lamont playing it safe, but I don't know, Paul Bass, hasn't that sort of been the Ned Lamont problem all along through a couple of different campaigns? He's a guy who's kind of seen as a safe candidate. He's kind of very cautious with what he says. We're not exactly sure about that big vision for the state. I don't know. He's not coming out and saying a ton, I think, that is getting the electorate very energized. Am I wrong about that?
I don't think he can.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen this. We've seen he spends $10 million and buys people to work for him, but nobody's inspired. So, like, even in New Haven, when he ran for governor in 2010, he had all the politicians on board. He bought everyone who works on campaigns. He even lost the city. I had one politician tell me that was the most boring hour I ever spent in my life. I talked to him. So I think you're right. I think one thing I'm looking at the Schubert is when you see these debates, because the Republicans were at the Schubert, the gubernatorial candidates, a few weeks ago, you see where the it's really a snapshot of where political issues are. So when the Republicans were here, every one of them had to show that they hate sanctuary cities. And Herbst, who's trying to be, Tim Herbst, trying to be the most Trumpian of the candidates, you know, was talking about how he's going to threaten all the mayors by name in cities. And I think you're going to see everyone, you know, Ganim, who in fact was not a pro-sanctuary person, even when he was elected mayor, he went to Fairfield at the bus station, one of his great, and he does have a great knack for the visual, when he went to Fairfield station and asked all the advocates to make their city a sanctuary city. But you're going to see down the line on issues like the justice nomination, sanctuary cities, Roe versus Wade, that you're going to, you'll see where the party stands. I think this, I'm going to be a hypocrite now after what I told Liz before. I don't think there's any daylight in what issues they're adopting. I think it is a personal issue. Like, I think Ganim's right when he says, what makes you think when you've never held political office or won an election and can't aspire, when you're actually going to be able to go to Hartford and tell, you know, really negotiate legislators around the city? I think Lamont's right that how do you think anyone's going to vote for you who's not a hardcore urban Democrat? I mean, I think he might get under 30% if you're over the general election candidate like Bruce Morris in 1990. And unfortunately, I think that those are the real issues between the candidates.
What do you see?
So, I mean, and the interesting thing about Lamont is it seems like the grass has no roots is sort of what you said, right? I mean, you know, there's sort of that. Yeah, the rubber stuff that all the that's toxic. you know, your point about what to anticipate in the Democrat debate is that it sounds like that they're all running for U.S. Senate.
That's not true.
I was there. They talked a lot about jobs. They talked a lot about the tax climate in the state. They talked a lot about the economy in
the
state.
Yeah, they're going to get rid of the income tax. Like, that's going to happen anytime soon.
They talked a lot about state issues. And even on the federal side, when they were talking about some of the federal issues, they were talking about how it impacted the communities in our state. So
Democrats will talk about investment, infrastructure, higher ed.
But if they're going to be honest about those issues, when you talked about Roe v. Wade and things like that, then they're going to have to acknowledge the fact that those things are not in jeopardy here in Connecticut, and that through bipartisan
support. But the examples you brought, they'll talk about tax policy, incentives for investment, local hiring. I hope they do talk about those things,
and I hope that they talk about what will make them different from Dan Malloy, because so far we've got Ned Lamont, who's promised to do exactly what Malloy did, which is raise taxes and look at revenue grabs as a way to fix the problems in the state instead of addressing the real issues.
This old idea, Neil, of how to differentiate yourself from a governor who's a Democratic governor who just served two terms, that's a pretty dicey proposition for these guys standing up there and saying, well, we're going to be different, not exactly sure how, and what our playbook is to get out of the hole that we find ourselves in. We're not really sure what that playbook is either.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things is, first of all, we know that Dan Malloy did not support, you know, Ganim in his return to politics and running for Bridgeport mayor. We know Lamont's history with Malloy in terms of losing the primary in 2010. Another thing I recall is that Lamont was the leader in the polls against Malloy going into the primary in 2010, and Malloy really accused him of dodging on debates and not really giving him a fair hearing and you know, an opportunity to debate the issues. And it seems to me that I covered the 2006 primary campaign against Lieberman. I think that Ned does well when he takes risks and, you know, does not play it safe. And, you saw he lost the primary and then he lost the general election.
He won the primary. He lost the primary in 2010.
I'm glad you brought up the 2006 race, Paul, because the thing that galvanized people in support of Ned Lamont during that primary and made him a national figure was because he was opposing the Iraq War, and he was opposing Joe Lieberman's very staunch support of the Iraq War. He was, at that time, a one-issue candidate, but a very passionate one-issue candidate.
He was also for single-payer health care. Joe was bought by the industry.
And Joe is definitely not for single-payer health care. Right. But the issue was that when you got past that primary, you got into a general election, Ned Lamont didn't really differentiate himself on anything other than the Iraq War, maybe on health care, but that's not what people were rallying behind Ned Lamont for. And he doesn't have that one issue right now. There's not one thing to get excited about Ned Lamont for an awful lot of voters. It's not to say he can't come up with with that, but it doesn't feel like it's there in the way it was in 2006.
I agree, and to Neil's point, so that was an issue he felt strongly about at the right time, Iraq War. But he also, remember he took a vacation right after he won the primary and Joe started hitting him, putting on the defensive in the general election day one. That's Ned. I know he's got the fire in the belly because even with the Iraq War position, which he did feel strongly, and you're right, both of you, I think, that that's what animated him. He also has this delusion about what 2006 was. He was a creation of the left of the Democratic Party. Tom Swann went around trying to recruit a good candidate against Joe Lieberman, and everyone said no. Juan Figueroa said no. Roger Van said no. Well, he said, well, here's some rich guy who actually believes this and has tons of money. Let's go with him. And he ran a great primary campaign. And Joe and Ned keeps saying he wants to recapture that spirit, but that spirit wasn't really about Ned Lamont. It was about a moment in history when the Democratic Party in Connecticut was moving left around the Iraq War, and he was the person they pushed in front.
But I'll just quickly ask you, though, on this. You mentioned the single-payer health, which is something that, again, people don't remember from that 2006 campaign. Well, here you go. I mean, you're running for governor. You have an opportunity to do something at the state level. I mean, do you start talking about our healthcare system in Connecticut? Do you start talking about the fact that maybe Connecticut could save money for people by going to some sort of different system than other states have? But again, there's nothing there.
And even there, the problem is Connecticut had the best Obamacare system in the state. Not only did it run the best with the computer systems, they stole our guy to run it in D.C.
Yeah, they did.
But it's in good shape. They actually did what all nonprofits need to do, which is they created their own revenue stream so that if the federal spigot got turned off, they could still survive. So you're right. I think single payer is a really animating issue in other states, but in Connecticut, you can be for it, but you don't really have to move. Although I guess the Republicans might reverse it.
I mean, that 2006 primary that Lamont won, I mean, that was, you know, a rejection by the Democrats of the Iraq War. There was that famous image of George W. Bush kissing Joe Lieberman on the cheek after the 2005 State of the Union address. And that really kind of crystallized what Ned Lamont was all about. About in 2006 and why he won that primary.
I want to turn actually to one of the Republicans in the race, Steve Opsitnik, who's still waiting for $1.35 million in public campaign financing. He's still waiting to get this grant in part because it's tied up with the SEC. Can you just maybe give us a little bit of an update, Neil, and then I'd love to hear from Liz on Steve Opsitnik as he fits into all of these other candidates that we're going to talk about in just a bit who are already spending a lot of their own money on television ads.
Well, I think the Opsitnik campaign is cautiously optimistic that they'll finally get their money this week. And I've heard from rival campaigns that they think that could be indeed be the case. The question is, has this delay, the fact that Tim Herbst and Mark Boughton got their money 3 weeks ago, and the fact that David Stemmerman is in for $13 million and Bob Stefanowski has been on the airwaves for months, the big question for Opsitnik is it too late in the game for him to kind of make up ground? And, 6 weeks, and it's a sprint until the primary.
What do you say?
Well, if he had just started his campaign, literally, like right now, I would say yes, right? But the fact is he's been running for a while, and so, you know, to the extent that he has his grassroots folks that are out there, and I know they're knocking doors and making calls and things like that. I mean, so he's not completely new to the scene. I think, you know, clearly you need paid media in order to, get your message out. What's interesting, though, is, there was an article that he may try and put his own money in. I don't know how that works from a regulatory standpoint, clearly they're feeling the heat and he's trying to figure out how to remain competitive. I think the money is important. Obviously, he's got to get in and get in the mix, but I don't think that it's everything, because if he's got people who are true believers and they're ready to go to the polls regardless of whether or not he has his money, will he win? Probably not, but I don't think that the absence of money is going to
But when you've got this many candidates, Liz, we were talking about how on the Democratic side you've got two people
sure.
who are trying to differentiate themselves yep. from each other. And honestly, there's not a whole lot to differentiate on the issues. On the personalities, there certainly is. How do you sort out all these guys? There's the two rich guys who are putting their own money into it. There's the Mark Boughton.
Could be a third rich guy putting his own money into it.
I mean, how do you sort these people out in terms of either politics, personality, you know, what people might come to the polls for?
Well, look, I think, you know, you've got, just from a practical standpoint, the generally speaking, you know, getting the parties endorsement, regardless of whether it's Democrat or Republican, when you're on the top of the ballot, it's generally worth about 5 points, right? When you just, you know, all right, he won already. That's the guy I'm going to fill in the SAT bubble for. But I think what's interesting is, if you look at what happened in New York in that congressional primary, you had low turnout, which I think we can expect here in Connecticut.
It's fair to say.
You know, I think there's probably going to be a low turnout. What happens when you have a primary?
120,000 people, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, on the Republican side, I think we'll be lucky to get 100,000 voters to turn out. I mean, I think that, you know, but the point is, in that New York primary, it was really that energizing, emotional factor that made the difference. And I think that's where, you know, our folks and frankly, that's the Ganim argument, right? And that's what we were just talking about with Lamont, making that emotional argument. And so, you know, in politics, as in most things, hearts before minds, right? I mean, people make a decision about, well, Republicans probably less so maybe it'll be a little bit different, but people still want to believe.
I don't know. 2016 may have disproven your theory.
Yeah. Well, maybe that might be true.
Potential. Let's just rewind the tape on that one.
But I do think that on the state side, it might be like, I really
Fair
like
enough.
That guy's tax plan, or, you know, I really like that guy's, transportation position or something like that. So I do think people are a little bit more in the weeds because the policies are something that touch them every day. But I think ultimately people make decision about who they're going to vote for based on what their heart and their gut tells them. And I think you have to see these candidates kind of tap into that a little bit more.
Yeah.
And I think some of the ads have done that, right? I mean, Boughton's talking about his brain, you know, pulling a little bit on emotional heartstrings. Bob Stefanowski is talking about, you know, sort of that, you know, play on Bob the Builder and trying to, you know, get people's heartstrings. You've got Stemmerman talking about his experiences, like, you know, sort of talking about some of how he met his wife and his pets and things like that. So I think people are starting to try and pull at those emotional heartstrings.
And we're going
to
hear some of those ads, specifically the Stefanowski and Stemmerman, in just a moment. And there's some similarities in there, Paul. I'm just wondering if you could break down what you see out of these Republicans so far, because again, with so many people in the race, you don't want it to be a caricature of like Tim Herbst is the kind of, he's not really Trumpian policy-wise. He's just sort of a often angry-sounding guy.
Oh, he was saying all that Trump stuff about all the illegals are committing, making people unsafe in New Haven, committing all these crimes. I mean, that was just
But I mean, how do you sort out all these?
I see it as about government experience. It was actually Erin Stewart, who's running for lieutenant governor, was on my show, and she said, in both parties, they're making this mistake. They're thinking just because you can run private business, that makes you qualified for government when you have no experience. Everyone's trying to run this idea like in those two ads. I'm an outsider. I have no experience. I mean, was that what you would say when you're hiring someone to run your company? And so I think partly it's about it. Also, Liz's question, I was interested in because she was talking about the air. You need money to go on air. We just had three elections, especially two gubernatorial elections, where Republicans were supposed to win. And yet self-funding candidates who spend tens of millions of dollars to be on the air, and yet Democrats who really did the grassroots organizing and won. Now, separate from the Linda McMahon one, but the Foley races, I mean, Malloy was very low in popularity, but he won that race. And I'm wondering, when you need only 20,000 votes to win a primary, is it going to be who has the most commercials, or is it going to be who gets people on the ground? Because that's what I think New York was. Ocasio.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. It never is, right? I mean, it is about, that's what I'm saying. It's about hearts before minds. You have to engage people's
hearts. You can do hearts through air war. You do hearts through on the ground.
You can, but there has to be an authentic, you know, sort of like emotional appeal. People have to, look, you want to get people out to vote in the middle of August and they can be sitting on a beach. You got to have true believers. You have to have people that are going to run through a brick wall on fire for you.
But isn't this, and we talked about this last week. Let's hear from these ads and we can talk about this just afterward. Stemmerman and Stefanowski, let's see if we can tell which one is which.
The last 8 years under Governor Dan Malloy has been a disaster for Connecticut. Families gone. Companies gone. I'm David Stemmerman. I used outside-the-box thinking in the business I built from scratch by seeing opportunities where others could not.
Dan Malloy wrecked Connecticut's economy. Bob Stefanowski is running for governor to rebuild it from the ground up.
Call me Bob the Rebuilder.
Bob Stefanowski spent his career...
If you look at these two ads, Neil, I mean, they both employ wrecking ball imagery. Dan Malloy has wrecked the state, and they're going to, in some way or other, rebuild the state. We can talk about the wrecking ball analogies in just a second, but I want to get to Liz's point. Yeah, maybe true believers. Yeah, you need a ground game, but I don't know. People need to know who these candidates are, and I don't think it's entirely clear to people in Pomfret who Mark Boughton is. It's certainly not clear to a lot of people in and around the Hartford suburbs who Bob Stefanowski is. It's why you have paid media, right? You have to at least get people's names out there.
One a huge kind of conundrum, I think, for Republicans is it's clogged. You've got five guys, in the primary.
Not the burgers and fries.
Yeah, not the burgers
right
and
now.
Fries. And I think that people only have only so much attention span and bandwidth, and you have these candidates that are reduced to sound bites and like little kind of homespun things about how they met their wife or how many kittens they have. And,
no offense, John.
I have more kittens than any of the candidates at this point, but please continue.
I know from, having talked to some of the people, David Stemmerman, feels like if you get 45 minutes in a room with the guy that he can make a compelling argument about his, background running Kanatus Capital hedge fund. But when you get, reduced to, 90 seconds on a debate stage, it's very difficult to distinguish yourself from the other people.
Did you want to jump in, Liz?
Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one who thought of Miley Cyrus on the wrecking ball issue. I won't get that image out of my head. Thank you very much, Neil Vigder. Check it out on Twitter. Neil has a wonderful image that you can review for yourself and decide whether it's funny or not.
Well, look,
I figured I'd give you a little plug there.
If it's difficult to sort of figure out in this governor's race what's going to be most important, we're going to have 20,000 people deciding the victor. I don't know, Paul, you suggested maybe this lieutenant governor's race is the more interesting one to watch, especially
four,
in the cities.
You have four really interesting candidates for the governor who not only have interesting personal stories, but reflect some of the most interesting trends in politics.
So there's five. So there's two on the Democrat side. You have.
Oh, I'm missing one of the Republicans. Joe Markley.
Joe Markley, Jamie Stevenson, and Aaron Stewart.
Yeah. So, but I find that really interesting because in both cases, you have a 31-year-old woman who's arguing that you need generational change in their party and you have to broaden your base. And then you have, in the case of Susan Bicewicz, who first was running as, hey, you need to have a woman on the ticket. Now he's facing a woman who's not only a woman, but a Latina, who got 40% of the delegates at a convention and has all the energy in the
you
race.
You need to have me on the ticket.
Right. Yeah. 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 Now, point. Now yeah. All of a sudden. Yeah. And then not about box
checking. And then the Republican side, you have Joe Markley, who, I love Joe Markley. He's a really sweet, wonderful guy. He's the furthest right of any Republican ever elected in Connecticut. Well, tied to his friend Tom Scott. By the way, they're both with Stefanowski, who's a friend of Juwaniski. So that's a whole part about that. And that's really about supply side economics. But here you got a guy who in the past has always been a rebel, Joe Markley. The party endorsed him because they wanted under no way were they going to allow Aaron Stewart to get
That's
a nomination.
Not what That's what not happened? What happened. I mean, what happened was Aaron came into the race literally a day before the
because
convention.
Because they snubbed her for governor.
No.
Aaron started
her gubernatorial campaign very late. This is about process.
But remember how they attacked her, though? I mean, you immediately had Chris Powell, Kevin Ray, the right of the party went after her from day one.
I mean, I having been a part of the process, I did not see that at all. I was a delegate. I mean, I couldn't disagree with you more. I think Aaron's problem was a runway problem. I think if she had gotten into the race earlier, I don't know that that's necessarily true. And if she had gotten into the lieutenant governor's race earlier, I don't know that that's necessarily true. So I'm gonna wholeheartedly disagree.
Well, you do
with
know
you
more
that.
About this. I just heard somebody when I saw those first attacks on her right away. I think because she raised taxes,
but those
she had Latino
from members
support.
Of the media.
Nope,
that did not come from people in the the party. I would caution you on that. That I don't see that that was the issue. I think Aaron has just got into this thing late, and I think her late decision to change races became problematic. And that's bared itself out in the fact that she's only halfway to her fundraising goal the second time around. There was a lot of excitement for her, and there was a lot of support for her when she first got into the race. She raised over $100,000 in a very short amount of time. I think that the quick change, I think that let some people down. So I'm really going to push back on you on that. That wasn't what happened.
I mean, Neil, we can spend time another couple minutes talking about the lieutenant governor's race. This is not necessarily something that a lot of people spend too much time investing in. The lieutenant governor is not a job that has a very high profile over the course of the next several years. Do we care about who's on the under ticket here?
I think to the unaffiliated voters who make up the largest voter block in the state, I don't think that they follow this stuff closely. I think that for the parties themselves, come November, if you have Markley as the nominee for lieutenant governor, and if Bisewitz is able to survive against Eva, I think that the left and the right will make their attacks on them, and Democrats will say that Markley is affable but very far to the right. The Republicans will make an issue of Bisewitz changing races and having run for so many different offices.
We're talking with Neil Vigdor from the Hartford Current, Liz Karanowitz, our Republican political analyst, and Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent. We're going to come back and just talk a little bit about what's happening in New Haven. We talk so much about bailouts for Hartford, the city is going under. Well, what's happening in this city we're in right now? We're at Gateway Community College here on The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Neil Vigdor from the Hartford Current, Republican political analyst Liz Karanowitz, and Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent. Just a couple minutes left in the program, Paul, but we want to talk about your city, New Haven. We spend so much time talking about the politics at the state capitol surrounding bailouts of Hartford and whether or not the capital city is going to go under, how much we should all bear the brunt of the way Hartford has been run in the past and the debts that it faces because of some of the problems inherent in the city. What's going on in New Haven? Seems like there's some problems here.
We've got cognitive dissonance going on in New Haven these days because on one hand, New Haven's doing the best I've ever seen it, at least from the last 40 years or more. We got cranes everywhere. We have this incredible cultural scene. We have a tech sector that's doing very well. At the grassroots level, we have this amazing, it's too long to talk about it, a statewide show, but it's amazing come together of all the neighbors for a summer of like 800 events and we're going to each other's neighborhoods. And our government for years had been run better than in the other cities, despite the challenges cities face, especially with not being able to tax half the property, right? So all these other, Hartford was going under, we were doing pretty well. But now we do have, with state cutbacks and some other issues and pension debts, we now have a $30 million structural deficit out of a $530 or $40 million operating budget. And it's caused a lot of tensions that ripple down. And so now we had to raise taxes 11% just to balance this year's budget. That might not do the trick. So that's caused a real revolt. And our cops are all fleeing because we can't afford to pay as much as the suburbs. So the suburban departments are actually coming to our cop academy graduations, picking out who they're going to hire. And after like 2 or 3 years, Hamden pays $30,000 more a year for a cop, and the benefits are better. So, and the schools, it's been a mess too, politics, that. So at the same time, especially in the summer, New Haven shines. I mean, you have the big 1,000 people riding in the Rocky Rock cycling. You have the Arts and Ideas Festival. You have the theaters and the cabarets and everything, and the summer stuff. And at the same time, we're wrestling with a past due bill for our local budget that's rippling down into the schools and the police department.
And as we know from what happened with Governor Malloy at the state level, if you have to raise taxes and that doesn't close the gap, doesn't solve the problem, then you've really got a problem because, Mayor Hupp, they're going to have to go back. I mean, where is the money going to come from to solve a $30 million structure deficit?
And we did that once before, which is why West Haven, Hamden, Bridgeport, and Hartford are actually in worse financial condition. We actually reduced a lot of our public works department and parks over the years, doing more with less over a lot of years. But now the money's now going to have to come from bone. We're now having a big discussion in New Haven about how you reimagine government and what do you decide government cannot do anymore structurally, because you can't like sell a building or or get a new influx of tax revenue to solve this problem.
And do you expect that the Democratic candidates are going to talk at all about that tonight?
Zip.
Yeah, or I guess it's tomorrow night.
Double zip.
Double zip. Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent. Paul, always good to see you. Thanks for all
thanks,
the great
John.
Work. Thanks also to Liz Kranowitz, our Republican political analyst. Thank you, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks also to Neil Vigdor from the Hartford Courant. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
Boy, it's been a chaotic, fun morning here at Gateway Community College. Thanks also to the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network, for being here. Scott Brady is the producer of The Wheelhouse. Katie Talarski is our executive producer. Thanks to Kyle Wolf, Carlos Mejia, Diane Orson, and Tucker Ives. You all helped us out today. This is The Wheelhouse.